When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Americans tried to buy the U.S. Embassy. This has always been my favorite story. And the story goes that they wrote to the Duke of Westminster. The letter came back. Gentlemen, you can have the embassy site. Once you give me back my lands in West Virginia...
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Sean Kelly is the author of Home Bases, Memories and Stories of US Military Bases Around London, which for the first time puts the spotlight on the history of many of the US military's lesser-known command and support bases that were located in or close to London. The bases, often known as Little Americas, are furthermore brought to life in a series of snapshot memories. We hear about the heroism of US personnel who were awarded the George Medal for bravery rescuing people caught in the Great Floods of 1953 in East Anglia. By contrast, we also hear about actor Larry Hagman, who played J.R. Ewing in the TV series Dallas, and how a murderer was caught by the watchful eyes of US medical personnel. The interview also covers memories of bases further afield, such as Upper Heyford, Greenham Common, Sculthorpe, and Burton Wood. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate.
Hello, I'm Nick Packham from Worthing in the UK. I support the Cold War Conversations podcast financially, as it's important that these stories and experiences from the Cold War are preserved before they're lost. Whether you grew up in the Cold War era or you're starting to look into what it was all about, there's something here for everyone.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Sean Kelly to our Cold War conversation. We've been trying to line this up for some time. I mean, I did meet you, I think it's probably about 4.5 years ago on a tour of Upper Heyford, the ex-US Air Force base, wasn't it?
Yes, and still probably one of the few that's got a Cold War listing prep for preservation here in the UK, the flight line area and the hardened aircraft shelters. And just still one of my favorite bases.
Yeah, but it was a great day, really great day, and managed to get an episode out of it as well, which is always
a
bonus. The Upper Heyford episode is episode 65. There will be a link in the episode notes for that. So, you know, we're here to talk about your book, and this is where I grab it so that I make sure I get the title right. Your book, Home Bases, which is Memories and Stories of US Military Bases Around London. What's your personal link here?
Well, a very personal link, because I was born on one of them, and I went to school on two others as a military dependent, effectively. As you know, World War II, we'll wind back if that's okay with you. World War II basically ended. The Americans went home. And at that point, it all seemed relatively quiet. But very quickly, the Cold War set in, and the Americans came back again. So in the early 1950s, you found people coming back and starting to build up the presence. And that just continued, as you know. And then some ebbs and flows, but essentially largely went away in the 1990s. And then again, pretty much fully around London in 2006. And that was the last real remaining presence was the U.S. Navy, effectively, for any great number of people. Home bases was sort of a love letter to all the bases that are not really flight line bases, the command and control bases around London. So I was born on a base called South Ruislip Air Station, USAF, about 17 miles west of London. And it was my mother had come over with my father. He had been a Fulbright scholar. He had been in the U.S. Navy. However, he'd gotten out of the U.S. Navy. He'd done his time in the 40s and decided to study art as a Fulbright scholar. He'd actually been out in the Pacific. And at the end of the war, he'd spent about 45 days towing a dry dock out to a small place called Bikini. And then saw a couple bright flashes, as they say.
Yeah.
And so he decided after his time in the Navy as a signalman, to come out and study art. He loved it, and he came to Paris first in the mid-50s, and then they arrived in London, Paris in the early 50s, and then they arrived in London in 55. And then my mother went to work for the U.S. government. She found a job working for the U.S. government as a teacher for a dependent school for the children of personnel around the area who were here with their parents and needed an education. Many of them were three or four year terms here. And so that's how I ended up being born at South Ruislip, which was the headquarters base until about 1972 or so, 73, somewhere around there, where it effectively became the headquarters at Mildenhall. They moved to Mildenhall. So I started being born there, and that hospital there was a 100-bed hospital. So wow. It was significant. When school time came along, I went to a small place called Eastcote. Eastcote was another U.S. Air Force base about 3 miles away from South Ruislip. Eastcote was elementary school for me. And then I moved to a place called Dawes Hill High Wycombe for high school. And that for me was the home of a place called London Central High School. Dawes Hill itself, and maybe we'll come back to this, was this amazing base that was Station 101 in World War II. It was the top secret pine tree. It was where an underground secret bunker was from which all the mission orders, all the tasking orders for the U.S. Army Air Force, 8th Air Force Bomber Command were issued. So history was kind of made on that hillside. I spent 6 years there in school and then graduated and then eventually went back to California for a few years and then came back and worked there again, actually. So a lot of history for me in this. And I think I'll preempt you by just saying that why write this book? Very simple. As I say, there have been a lot of books about, and superb books too, about all the flight line bases around the UK, all the American super base books, etc. There had been nothing about these bases that were not the sexy bases. And what I was seeing suddenly was that history was beginning to disappear. These places were being closed down, bulldozed, redeveloped, lost in many cases. And also the memories of those people were going. I'd had a hard lesson on this, Ian. I wrote a book a few years before in 2007 about London Central High School, this dependent school. And I'd done it really simply, one of the best ways you could, by interviewing your former teachers. Now, these people come over in the 1950s and on and had been teachers, some of them like my mother had been for 35 years or so a teacher. And I didn't interview enough of them in time. I always regretted that. And so I immediately started trying to interview people for home bases. I needed to do some history. I can't take history. I failed at history miserably. It was not my favorite thing. but I needed to get some history in there about why, how the Americans had ended up over here and so forth. So a little bit of the book is history. Then there's a whole look at each of the bases around. And if we run through some of those, you have, where do we start? So I said High Wycombe. That's 34 miles west of London. We said South Ruislip, 17 miles west of London. West Ruislip was another support base for that. But also, there were places like Denham Film Studios at one point, which was used in the support of the U.S. Air Force operations. They rented out for the sound stages. And that for storage, and they kept things there. They put, you know, food there and equipment and so forth, and shipped stuff around to the other bases from there at one point. And then you had, as I said, Bushy Hall, Bushy Park, and some of them had the Cold War relevance and some didn't. Certainly, Dawes Hill, High Wycombe had an incredible Cold War relevance. But it was the third part of the book was to just try and interview people, and I managed to get some from World War II. Obviously, I managed to get a couple guys who were here and instrumental in reopening up the top secret bunker at High Wycombe in the early 1950s, probably around 53, I think it was. They came over. They were sent here to effectively take back the base. For some years after High Wycombe closed, there was the civilian community was allowed to live in some of the buildings and so forth. But they had to go back in, and they had to pump like 10 feet of water out of the secret underground bunker, get it going again, and get ready to take on the Soviets. Fascinating story. It would become this whole 7th Air Division sort of operation, in a sense, be set up, we hoped, not for combat, but ready in case the worst came. And so their stories were really important. And it wasn't just their stories. I pick people across the areas and across the bases to try and interview and grab. So that was the whole thing. Capture these things while you can. As a historian, as a lover of history, and I do love history. I'm not very good at it, but I do love it. It was really important. This stuff is gone or going, much of it. Of course, you know, it may be needing to come back in current world situation. Who knows?
You're echoing there very much the reason why I started Cold War Conversations was to capture these oral histories. And as you've probably experienced doing your interviews, there's nothing like hearing it from somebody who was there. Whilst books can be, you know, effective mediums, and obviously your book is one of those effective mediums. I love audio. I love to hear somebody's voice because I just think you get a lot more nuance and depth in, you know, the intonation, the pauses, and all of that that you hear in the speech that you don't necessarily get from a book.
I agree. I mean, one of the things is, of course, I should have recorded more of those people I interviewed. I didn't think about it at the time. It just was, to me, important to just get their words down. Sure, I interviewed a few of them and got the recordings, but I never thought, you know, you've done a remarkable job with a podcast, because this brings it home to a whole new generation of people who like to access material that way. I don't know, this, you know, Home Bases is a 444-page tome, and there's a lot in there. You have to read it carefully. It's tightly written in terms of not word-wise. Well, word-wise, no. It's 444 pages of words. But it's small, you know, it's like 11-point print. And I was trying to pack a lot in, probably too much. But having that audio, having those experiences, hearing somebody pause is exactly what you say. You can get a lot out of that. The silence sometimes is as telling as whatever anybody says.
Yeah, absolutely. The silence can be far more powerful than the words that they're saying. But yeah, you're right. I mean, of those bases that you mentioned, I mean, Dawes Hill, High Wycombe, is one that I'm certainly familiar with from the Cold War. But I think it's, you know, I wasn't necessarily aware of how many US bases there were in London, because I think you think of a US base as being somewhere with a runway, whereas some of these places were not. They were like administrative units, I guess.
Very much so. Administrative support. For instance, Eastcote. In World War II, that had been an outlying base for Bletchley Park, one of the Station X bases, I guess you call it. And a U.S. Navy had actually been there in World War II. sometime up until probably the 60s or 70s, when the U.S. Air Force took it over, sometime I think in the late 50s there, it was not the prettiest of buildings. As a matter of fact, it quite often got mistaken, I think, in people's minds for a World War II camp called Eastcote. I think that's up in Yorkshire. But believe me, as a kid, this was a single-story building. It was all gray brick. It was ugly. We went to classrooms in there. But as part of the base, it was separated off into different things and had different uses over the years. As part of it, we were kept away from. Why? Because the 3rd Air Force had its mortuary there. So any Americans who died on bases over there would usually come to the 3rd Air Force mortuary at Eastcote, and they would be processed there by the mortuary team. And there is a memory or two in the book of that, and including it was from there. And you ask about oral history. My mother, you know, had told me a couple. I thought there were urban legends. They weren't. There had been a case of a woman had come in, been brought in, an Air Force wife had been brought in, and she, you know, was being processed to go back to the States when the mortuary person, who my mother knew, because he was a parent, I believe, of one of the kids she had, noticed that her fingernails were blue. Of course, you know what that means.
No, I don't.
Definitely poisoned. And it turned out to be a major case. And I think it was a staff sergeant was arrested. Turned out, I believe, that he had been having a relationship with a young British woman. She was a chemist of some sort. And anyway, he ended up doing, I think he ended up going back to Fort Leavenworth in the end. But we were never allowed in that area, you know, just in case. God forbid we saw a hearse coming in or something. But things like that, there were those sort of support operations were around. Of course, the base at Eastcote would later on go on to become, it would kind of shut down in the 70s, and the U.S. Marines would end up moving out there. Not the embassy Marines, per se, but the security force detachment Marines, the guys who go to rescue missions and so forth. And they would end up having their barracks there. And so it was there was all sorts of, you know, different times, different uses for places. It is fascinating in terms of how you look at the changing, evolving things. People had different, as I say, different uses. And at some point here, the U.S. Air Force obviously came out in the early 70s. So a lot of things changed at that point when they moved to Mildenhall. The real takeover of those, some of those bases, West Dryslip, Eastcote, High Wycombe, by the U.S. Navy happened in the 1990s. And they then, finally in 2005 and 6, kind of got an order. And you'll read about it. It's one of the last chapters in the book. The captain of the U.S. Navy here in the U.K. at the time got an order to take everything to zero from the Pentagon, pretty much. Some admiral there. And I still think, and I've been quoted on this, I still think that was a major mistake. And even more so in the light of current world events as we're now facing with Ukraine in 2022. I think that was a massive mistake. But I would say that because I was very fond of all these places. So the U.S. Navy had its headquarters in London on North Audley Street, number 7 North Audley Street. A 6-7-story building there. It was a pig of a building. It was, I think, it had been maybe a hotel or something before it had been taken over in World War II. But there were stairways. Those people who served there will remember there were stairways that went nowhere. They went up about 3 steps and stopped, and then there was a wall. Some really unusual stuff. But that building has now been. They sold it off in 2006-07 after they were told to go to zero. They sold it off about the same time they were selling the U.S. Embassy. So this whole area of Grosvenor Square, which since World War II had been this sort of Eisenhower Platz, if you can put it that way, this whole America, little America, is no more there. $250 million or so for that building. And you see, there were other little buildings too. So the admiral for the U.S. Navy here actually had a registered home since World War II at the next to the Wentworth Golf Course in Surrey.
Not bad. Not bad, address. Course,
and they sold that one too for about £4 million, I believe. Pounds, this is. So, and the embassy, the U.S. embassy in London, of course, famously subject of a lot of speculation at times, being redeveloped now as a sort of hotel, I believe, by the Qataris, I think it is. And they've moved to Battersea, obviously, Nine Elms Battersea. That building there, of course, was on a, like the U.S. Navy headquarters, was on a 999-year lease. The Americans tried to buy the U.S. embassy. This has always been my favorite story. The Americans tried to buy it for years. They wanted to buy it. And it was owned by the Duke of Westminster, the late Duke, and now his son. So that whole area of Mayfair, owned by Grosvenor Estates. So apparently they had to pay an actual peppercorn rent a year on this. For years, the Americans were trying to buy it. Apparently, they really pushed at it one time. And the story goes that they wrote to the Duke and said, look, we're the United States of America. Let's buy this place. You know, we want to buy it. We want to own our own. It's the only embassy in the world we don't own the site of. And apparently the letter came back, gentlemen, you can have the embassy site once you give me back my lands in West Virginia from historic lands taken many, many years ago in a certain revolution. So I love those little things. The U.S. Navy headquarters in London.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
When it shut, I was able to go in there a couple weeks after it shut. And at some point, I'll put the pictures up online. And it was a tour. I just had about an hour in there. Went through and shot as much as I could. Fascinating because there it was a 999-year lease. I've got a copy of that lease or the page in the book there. I think it cost him like £100,000, but also £1, you know, effectively it was nothing. But capturing people's memories, critical. And many of these bases are now gone. High Wycombe Air Station, I'll go back to that. So World War II, they put in this bunker. Three-story bunker. Well, it wasn't. It was a single story at the time. And anybody who loves their history will know, I have to relate this to young people in a way they can understand. Did you ever see Memphis Belle, the film?
Yeah.
Okay, so many people will have seen that. That plane and every other heavy bomber plane got its tasking orders, as I say, from that hillside, from that bunker, or from that hillside some point in World War II. It closes down. It becomes a Cold War place. It is a unique building. Because right now, it's the only thing left of that base. And let me explain this. So when they built it as a concrete block within a concrete block. And in between about a meter and a half of dead space. And it effectively sits on some architectural springs. So if the building were hit by German bombers in World War II, it might have shaken a bit. There's 25 feet of earth above the outer sort of thing, if they'd ever found it. When the closed down, the late Queen Mother and the King came to see it, and were they pictured there. The then went quiet. Then came along Lancer control in the 50s. It was revamped. The single story building that you can see in a online film called The Mission for Today. There are two points in there where you see a giant map room, and that is the famous map room. Everybody still asks about. Is that map still there? It's not there. That I've ever found. But this three-story building now for modern era, for the Cold War, to deal with the nuclear age, at some point was turned into a Faraday cage. How do you turn a place into a Faraday cage? Well, you wrap it in strips of copper inside. So there must be miles of copper in that building still. And if you look at certain points of the floor in there, when they allow an occasional tour, and they don't do them that often, I don't believe, then you can see these strips of copper banding in the floor there. Of course, it was modernized over the years. Certainly in the 1980s, there was a massive story in the Observer newspaper in the UK saying that it had received about £13 million worth of upgrade as they were moving on to take on additional elements of support in the Cold War. They put in two floors. They put in lots of computers. You can see where computers are stored in there. And they must have been heavy computers. You can also see a few things, including a really small little ports in occasional places. They not only had computer Halon.
Yeah, to remove the oxygen.
They had some Halon dump pipes in there. I don't think you can use those anywhere.
No, you anymore, can't.
You know, but at one point they had Halon dump pipes in there. But the other really fascinating thing they had in that bunker, it's still there if you can get around and see it ever, is a little thing called WWMCCS, I think it is. And it was the worldwide military computer system, effectively. But my understanding was that High Wycombe, which became a fallback headquarters in the later years, in, you know, since probably the 80s, for the U.S. military command in Europe. If Germany had been overrun by Soviet tanks, that would have been the fallback headquarters. It was one of only three places outside of the Pentagon where the war plan, the Pentagon's war plan, was sent to and updated every 24, 74, 72 hours. I've heard different numbers. And so that was a unique place. But it was, but when it came to closing it down, two great stories, and the one I love is when the U.S. Navy had it, they, I believe it didn't start until they took over the base, they opened up the bunker on Halloween. And you could go down there and be scared. They had hay rides down to the bunker, which was halfway down the hill, and you could go in there and be scared in an underground bunker. Also, at one point, the U.S. Marines used that for some sort of training, whether it be hostage rescue or whatever it was, aggression training, whatever. So parts of it had been damaged up. But what really happened was when the U.S. Navy decided to hand it back, the MOD looked around, and they were looking for another user for the base. They didn't find any, so they put it to the market. Of course, in the health and safety era, Ian, they left all the doors open for 3 or 4 years, right? Cold English winters, cold going into those things. But these are places, bunkers that had been modernized with ceiling tiles and so forth. So nature seeped in, if I can put it that way, and did some damage. So ceiling tiles were falling down, so forth. But people still ask about the original map. It's not there that we can see. What is fascinating, the most fascinating part of this whole thing, is this building is the only thing preserved, and here's why. It was sold. The American site was sold. Sorry, the original World War II site was partly Wycombe Abbey Girls' School, or Wycombe Abbey School, as it I think it is now, is. And then halfway up the hill where the bunker was, that was Wycombe Abbey School. And just above it there was on a long lease. It was a unique thing because it was the only other base around besides South Ruislip, really, that was called High Wycombe Air Station USAF. Most of them had, as you know, over the years, they put RAF in front of many of the names, or kept that, particularly in the Greenham Common era, where it would help to have even further separation. That bunker had to be returned under Critchell Down rules to Wycombe Abbey School. And so they own it now. But before it was returned, just before it was returned, English Heritage noted it. I don't know how to this day. And they said, oh, that's interesting. Historically, it's interesting because this is where U.S. Air Force 8th Bomber Command was. But architecturally, it's the only one of its kind. So they slapped it with a grade 2 star. I think it is a grade 2 star, which has its own additional responsibility, a preservation order, which means that while your listeners may not know this, but you don't have to necessarily go all guns out to preserve a place, but you can't just knock it down. So it's there. Who knows how long that bunker will last, but it's been there since 1939, 40, somewhere around there.
Well, these places aren't that easy to demolish either. I mean, in terms of cost. A number of these Cold War bunkers have been turned into like secure document stores and things like that. And certainly the tunnels under Warren Street and some of the other tube stations in London that were built as deep shelters, I think were converted into document stores.
Never a cheap thing to do when you go underground, though. Never a cheap thing to do, and always a risk of fire and so forth. Let me just jump over to another base because it fascinates me. It's a flight line base, but of course it had a link to High Wycombe, and that is Greenham Common. Now, Greenham, famous World War II, 101st Airborne, departed from there on D-Day, and then of course it then had a Cold War role. And then, of course, at some point, was it the early 1990s, the ground-launched cruise missiles showed up there. They built this special gamma area for that. And that's another place where today, of course, the base was closed down. The main runway was dug up and is used as part of the A-30 bypass. It's used as hard fill, right? So part of this two-mile-long runway, unique two-mile-long runway there, was dug up. And basically used for a motorway, which is fine. And that's not the first time that's happened. The Gamma, of course, these hardened aircraft, you know, pretty much to protect the nuclear missiles, massive bunkers with blast doors on them, protected with three lines of, you know, barbed wire fencing and so forth. Well, guess what? That's the National Monument, too. Now, it's privately held, but... at this point, much of the base has been redeveloped as something called, it was New Greenham Park. I think it's now Greenham Park. But you can still walk around and see that site, and it's something to see. But what happened, of course, they couldn't close the doors on it. They left them open. And at some point, numerous times, I'm sure, metal thieves got in and stole a lot of the control equipment for the doors and so forth. So there's no way to close those anymore. It'd take a fortune to do that. But that's still there.
Just the control tower is still there as well, isn't it?
Well, yes, it was. I tried to buy it. and at some point, they put it on the market and said, you know, come around, take a look. And I thought, you know, I can go put £1.50 into this. And I think in the end, the council bought it. When I saw it, it had been boarded up, but it had also been, all the windows had been smashed and so forth. And it's a beautiful area to walk or jog in there because you can see down where the old runway was, and some of the taxiways are still there, particularly around the Gamma and so forth. But then there's horses wandering in the early mist and so forth, so it's great. They now have a cafe there, and they're open a few days a week, and you can go there and have a drink, and they've done a little bit of a museum there now, which is really nice.
Yeah, I did an episode a while back on Greenham Common with, oh, I can't remember the guy's name, but he'd written a book on the history of Greenham. This was episode 18 with Jonathan Sayers, and the book is called In Defence of Freedom, A History of RAF Greenham Common. There'll be a link in the episode notes.
Yeah, so I'm just happening, since your readers can't see it, I was happening to hold up one of the inside of the Gamma. When they took the last missiles out, I was there. I was there for it. And I'm trying to remember the British minister now. Alan Clark. Alan Clark was the man, and he was there with a guy, General Marcus Anderson, of the 3rd Air Force commander at the time. And the last of the cruise missiles went out on a C-5, I believe it is. You know, my aircraft knowledge is useless for being a wannabe aerospace engineer at one point. But the moment they went out, I think, I'm going to lay claim to this and say I was the first journalist inside the Gamma to wander around, because we were allowed in there, and I just went right over there as soon as that plane started moving, right? Yeah. Over there inside. And of course, you know, there you've done the interview on the book, but there now several films have been made inside the Gamma. They've used that as a famous film, Star Wars, Fast and Furious. I don't know what else, but the great story, of course, was Robbie in the Daily Mail newspaper in the UK, in which a small pilot was flying over Newbury, looked over to his right, and saw a Star Wars aircraft parked down there, and that they got a great scoop out of that, I think. But that was, you know, I love those sort of things, and how they've used those things, and how bases do get used. Of course, with Greenham, and I don't know if you're they covered this or not, and this is what fascinated me. Once, as the strategic weapons deal came through, and they drew down Greenham, of course, the Soviets at the time had the right to visit. I think they had to give 72 hours notice. And the story goes, of course, that they couldn't lease it out. And what would you lease it for? I guess for drum, you put a couple rock bands in each of those Gamma shelters, or a mushroom farmer. I'm not sure which. But the problem they had was they couldn't lease it out for a long while because, apparently, if they had leased it out and the lessee had said, no, I'm not letting you in today, there could have been an international incident when the Russians showed up. Apparently, at the time, the story goes, the Russians used to come, say, oh, yeah, there it is. We're off shopping in London. And that was that. You know, another era, though. You know, a different time.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen some incredible photos of, like, Soviet aircraft at Greenham, which is, you know, they've flown in to inspect the place and make sure that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. But I think there was more on the shopping agenda is there any cruise missiles left around in that crevice over there number. So those things fascinate me. RAF Northolt was used by the Americans a little bit. And as a matter of fact, there is a story in the book about, I think, a security man who was sent over there to guard a plane. And it had in it a very special present going to the Soviet leader at the time, Khrushchev maybe. Apparently, this plane contained a boat. And the boat never made it because there was a small incident at the time with Mr. Gary Powers, I think it was. And that all kicked off. And then so the boat went back and it's somewhere in the United States. I don't know if it's still floating. I mentioned that in the book. I love all those stories. And there are some unique people, Ian, who served on these bases. And that's what, as you say, recording those memories of those people, so important. You know, I mean, I was lucky to be able to interview a lot of people.
If we just pick out a few of those stories of the people that served on the base. I mean, you've mentioned to me before we started recording Freeman Kilpatrick,
yes. Now, he had actually, I had to reach on this a slight bit, but he was exceptional. And in a sense, he and one other man represent the very nature of the special relationship between the UK and the UK and the United States. And when we talk about the special relationship, there's no more human relationship than this. He was an airman at Sculthorpe in the 1950s. And one day he was at home with his wife in a place called Hunstanton. And it's, I think it's January 53. He gets ready to go out with his wife for the evening to a film. And he goes out the back door and sees a small trickle of water. They're on these houses near the beach that are on stilts. Goes out and sees a small trickle of water. The next time he looks out, it's 14 feet deep. And these are the horrific floods of 1953, which killed 300 people on the east coast of England, including 17 airmen, I believe it was, or 17 airmen and their family members. And then went on and killed about another 1,000 in Holland and further down. This wall of water that built up and the winds and so forth was just an exceptional thing that happened. He went out and rescued people and kept trying to rescue people. And as a matter of fact, when he made it back to his house barely, it was floating away. And he and his wife and child had to get up on the roof of the house. And they were rescued some hours later, I believe it was. Likewise, another airman named Rhys Leeming, helped rescue numerous people. Both men are, and they're only two of five ever in the U.S. military, received the George Medal for bravery. And that's not the George Cross, which can only go to British military personnel. It's the George Medal. And even though they were American military personnel, they could receive it because they were allowed to. And they were presented this. And that had a massive impact on his life. But it wasn't just that. He had something else happen with a family member that brought him to London and to one of the London hospitals. It is, to me, one of the most moving stories ever. Now, I have to say that I managed to interview him before he passed away. I didn't ever interview Rhys Leeming, sadly. And a few years ago, his family, his son and their family, took the decision that they wanted to send his medal back to the UK. And they've sent it to the Sculthorpe Heritage Center. And Ian Brown there, who runs that, received this medal from them, and he's just been blown away. Well, upon hearing that, I have to say, the family of Rhys Leeming said, we'd like to send our medal back there too. And These are significant medals. These are without a doubt significant medals. There's another thing that the museum has. So they have two George medals now at this museum. That's so important. The curator, Ian, received a small call from somebody saying, I need to come look at the museum. They came along, looked, and said, you're going to have a visit tomorrow. And effectively, Her Majesty the Queen came on a private visit to see the medals that had been given out in her name. She hadn't been able to give them herself, but at the start of her reign, at the very start of her reign. So what an incredible thing. And those are available to see there. That personifies that relationship. So that's one thing there. I think you probably want to ask me about who else?
Well, you had Ellis Rollet.
Yeah, I'll mention Ellis. Ellis was a cousin of my mother's, actually. Now, he was a doctor. He'd come, I think he was on two times over here. He's in the book. And the reason I picked him was because something unique happened with him. And this goes to another link. So he was stationed at South Ryslip at the base hospital there for a few years. I think it was 57 to 59 was probably the key time. And he had learned a hard lesson in one of the New York hospitals when a patient had died on him and he couldn't save her fast enough. I don't know quite the detail, but it's sort of in the book there. But then from that time on, he'd always carried a scalpel when he was on his rounds. And I think he had a staff sergeant come in who had a massive pulmonary. And because he had that scalpel on him, he went right over, and having had this training, a lot of training in New York hospitals at that point, he cut him open there and then and did the UK's first open heart massage here.
Wow.
So he held a man's heart. You can imagine this in the late 1950s. That was national news. And I think that he was absolutely mobbed by press. Tabloid press saying, you know, you held it, what's it like? And he'd done the first time it had happened here in the UK. He was really embarrassed about it, but he'd saved the man's life. And that goes to point to two other things, actually. One is this. One is that there were a lot of links and a lot of research done by doctors here on flu and colds and so forth. And they were able to meet with the top London doctors. And they had some of those top doctors, some surgeons, some really expert people, gynecologists and so forth, who would come and do stints at the hospitals. That hospital there also had some great visitors. I think Muhammad Ali was one of their visitors at one point. So they saw a lot of people there. I never saw them because I was a baby. but there was one other case in the 1950s, and it's really, and this is Cold War stuff, you know. A nurse was over, and it was the, I want to say October 53, maybe. A terrible train accident happened. The Harold and Wealdstone train crash. It wasn't just one. It wasn't two. It was three trains that hit each other. The word went out. The hospital's 5 miles away, 4 or 5 miles away from this thing. Word went out. There have been a lot of fatalities and a lot of people injured. Can you send help? They threw up a nurse. Her name is Abby Sweetwine. She's passed now in 2009, I think it was. She threw stuff into her bag along with other airmen, and she and these guys all went over there and they started working on the platforms. She immediately recognized a problem that wasn't recognized, I guess, in the UK at that point, and that was that they were giving morphine to patients on the platforms. And the fear was that you could get double morphined, which was not a really good thing, I gather, from medical speaking. So what she did was she took her lipstick out of her purse and she began to put M's in red lipstick on each person's head, which meant that they'd had morphine, and she told each crew this. I don't know how it all came about.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
But whatever she did that day made a massive difference, and it actually apparently was taken on board by the NHS after that. And they also made sure that people were never over-morphined, I guess it is, again. So those are the medical sides. It's just little links there. Probably the last one I'd mention is Larry Hagman. He's my star guy. I managed to get a hold of Larry Hagman. I had always heard a story that Larry Hagman had served on a U.S. Air Force base in England.
Just explain to listeners who Larry Hagman is. Larry Hagman is probably most famous in the UK for being J.R. Ewing in the TV series Dallas. He's also featured in a number of films. I always remember him in The Eagle Has Landed as this sort of crazy U.S. Colonel, I think he is in that, who gets dispatched by a German spy partway through the film. But anyway, tell me about Larry Hagman's connection here.
And also, he was in I Dream of Jeannie, which I adored. So as a kid, I adored that. So I'll give that one in too. Look, Larry Hagman had come over to London in the 50s. He had been the son of a famous actress named Mary Martin. Some of your listeners will remember that she starred in one of my favorite movies of all time, I think, South Pacific. Big production, Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, so forth. He'd come over with his mother on, I forget which ship it was now, but they'd come over and they'd spent, they were here for about 8 months or so, I think it was 9 months, something like that, doing the stage version. And he was playing one of the seamen in this while his mother was starring in the show. Well, during this time, he got his call up. Uncle Sam called him and said, "Guess what? You're going to war, buddy." And Larry was quite straight up about this. You know, he was, I spoke to him when he was in California at the time. And he was quite straight up and he said, "There was no way I was going to go to Korea." So I pulled all the strings I had. And they'd met a chaplain on board the ship coming over. And the chaplain, they called him and said, "How can Larry do his time here in the UK?" And effectively, he went and did his basic training here in the UK. I forget where it was now, Sealand or somewhere like that, I believe it was. He was able to do his 6 weeks or 8 weeks of basic training out there. And then he came to U.S. Air Force headquarters at South Ruislip, and he spent 4 years there. Larry told me he had a barracks room there. He never slept in it one night. I think the U.S. Air Force got this thing in 1949, this base, and it was going to be a factory. And so some of the barracks rooms were like just rooms with four beds in them and then no ceiling on it. There was a wall and then there was, he said he never, and of course he had the money and spend his time in Swiss Cottage. So he ended up doing, taking over the role that you see him in I Dream of Jeannie, sort of entertainment officer, I guess you'd say, for the U.S. Air Force. And he'd arranged sorts of things. Now, he always said that he did 5 years in the military, 1 year on stage in London with the U.S. Navy, being Seaman Quail in South Pacific, and the other 4 years, guess what, with the U.S. Air Force. He did not like authority. And he really just spent as much time as he could out in the field. And this was really important because when he would go out and do some of these competitive shows, these USO sort of shows where they would compete for prizes and so forth, to go to a talent show, to go on to the biggest European military show. And he really loved that. But it was so important to him because guess what? He met his wife, a Swedish fashion designer here. And it was after one of those shows that he didn't remember where. They pulled the car up in a field somewhere and he proposed to her there. And of course, that was a very long Hollywood marriage. That was a really long one. So that was a bit of a celebrity thing. But Ian, there are so many stories that people have, and there's so many that I never captured, you know, that I'd love to capture. And they're good and bad. There's happy and sad. There were two great clubs in London. There were a lot of clubs in London. There was one great club in London called Douglas House in Bayswater. That was the enlisted men's club in London. And today I think that's the Lancaster Gate Hotel, not the very tall one near Lancaster Gate. It's one further up, just off a place called Leinster Terrace on Lancaster Gate. There was also the Columbia Club. That was the officers' quarters for 25 years or so, and it had moved from another place in Mayfair. They had, at the Douglas House, the story goes that they had senior ranks trying to get in there because they had some of the coolest bands come to play there. Ike and Tina, I think, came, Turner, really big names came there to play. And that was a very popular place with apparently young ladies around London who wanted to meet an airman.
The book Douglas House by Gerald A. Collins, who Sean interviewed for Home Bases, can be found online, recounting Collins's own memories of the place and his time there. You should be able to find it on abe.com. I'll leave a link in the episode notes.
There are little places like that, and then there are little monuments around, of course, and little, there are proper monuments and some things you'd never even think of that are around. And I was trying to pin all those down. I could do a whole another 10 years on it, but I won't, I don't think. Those places, the changes, at one point, I guess you saw it build up from 10,000 people to about 70 or 80,000 in the peak of the Cold War here in the UK, something like that. Of course, a quarter of a million probably, in maybe a million going through here in World War II. But 80,000 might have been a number for the bases. Sculthorpe had 10,000 on it. We didn't even mention a place called Burtonwood, which is further up north, but it's important.
Well, that was a huge bat. I mean, that's not far from where I live, and they've got a small museum there. And I did an episode on that as well. The Burtonwood episode is episode 74. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. It was a massive bat. I remember it used to, a big chunk of it was still there, and you used to go past it on the motorway, and there were these huge hangars and you could see all the taxiways.
Part of the M62, as you drive up and down it, it was the main runway. About a mile and a quarter of it is the main runway. Burtonwood was so important in Warrington. And so many people had, met airmen there, and relationships and, in whatever ways those take you in your life. And I was there on the very last day that base operated. And to see those 2,000-yard long hallways empty. So hallway, storage units so big, they had to have bicycles to get up and down them.
Well, they used to have a lot of vehicles and things there,
Jeeps,
didn't they? They had
huge
hangars for vehicles in case the Cold War went hot.
The great thing was, this was the big storage place. Everything was ready, pompous, I think it was, material. It was pre-provisioned material stored there. They had several 3,000-bed hospitals in boxes. They had rows and rows of Jeeps. I remember the figure somewhere of 80,000 gas masks in one part of the building. Wow. And these things were not just put in a box. They all had to be taken out and tested and made sure they were current. Jeeps had to be emptied out and then, made sure and checked every once in a while.
Yeah.
And so incredible amount. And of course the Army had a Navy and down in Hythe near Southampton. And there in a dockyard there, they kept the Army's Navy up to ocean going tug. To bring in some of the big ships if they ever had to. So I really, and all that's gone, of course, and been redeveloped now. I'm trying to remember the name. Omega Park, is it up there now? I think.
Where, at Burtonwood?
Yeah, Burtonwood.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big industrial estate and storage place for people like Amazon and stuff like that, I think.
Storied history and a great little museum there. And there are great little museums around. So, and we're going to see more. I mean, we're going to see more, I think some more interest in this in the coming years in some of these places because of some of the World War II anniversaries. Cold War doesn't seem to get the same sort of anniversary treatment, but some bits of it, and maybe now with, dare I even say, history trying to almost repeat itself. I don't know if I should say that or not, but, in a weird way, I think people will be, you've got to look back sometimes to understand what's going on.
I mean, I am seeing more interest in the podcast, not necessarily the interest that I would want to see on the basis of the circumstances. But I think people are sort of looking back to that period to see how it was handled and how people, you know, experienced it. Because, we're certainly seeing very much echoes of 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. And geez, are we, you know, that's a... So for me, there's a lot of great history here. There's a lot of what's intrinsic to the special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States is to be found. The equipment that wove that some of that considerable relationship or the circumstances is to be found on those former bases. And you find that a lot of GIs really had some of the best times of their lives. I'd love to hear from some of those people one day. Just, you know, yeah, I mean, you see it occasionally on Facebook sites and so forth. You know, I really had a fantastic time there. I miss that. Of course, we like, and I do like going back to the scenes of my youth. Maybe, you know, as we get older, is that better? I don't know.
No, well, I think, yeah, I mean, people are always nostalgic. Well, not always nostalgic, but they tend to be nostalgic about their youth and revisiting, yeah, that those locations. I can completely understand that. A question I did want to ask you is, were you living on the base when you were?
No. So, I used to have to take a bus. My parents ended up in London, and right. I was not far from these two R&R facilities, the Officers Club. They were in Bayswater in London, so I would see those places a lot. Douglas House being one of them. So I was there, and then I was taking a bus out, 40 minutes, whatever, to Eastcote, an hour or so to High Wycombe at times. But it was just a choice my parents had made. A lot of kids, and I should mention this because it is famous, a number of kids who were slightly older in the high school years at High Wycombe, they had a residence hall at High Wycombe. They had been the Airmen's Barracks. They had 1,200 airmen in these barracks at one point, two barracks, three stories. And during the Cold War, when the Air Force was occupying the bunker fully at that time, they had these guys on 24-hour shifts, you know, SAC sort of Strategic Air Command operations. And 1,200 of them, so they were all doing different things, but in three different shifts. But these two residence halls were used as the residence halls for the kids coming from places like Greenham Common, from a base called Holylock, the submarine base up in Scotland, in Dunoon, as it used to be, one sort of cove, one bay over from the Faz Lane, I think it is, effectively. And that had been a major, major, major base. And coming even from other parts of the world at times. But Greenham Common, Welford, the bomb dump at Welford, Fairford, which we didn't even talk about, and it is now massively in the news at the moment. That had been a major base for a long time. And then it went to Turnkey. Now you're finding that they've turned the key, and I think they're going to leave the door open there for a long time now. It's where four B-52s are currently, or were currently, parked. And so they come to this the school, and they stayed there either 5 days a week or 7 days a week. And the Bobcats, we're all known as the Bobcats, as our school, you know, logo, moniker. The great story was, and I'd heard this a few times, and you couldn't dispel people from this, the people of High Wycombe always thought that these three-story buildings, because you could see them when you walked, there's a public footpath, well, as with Eastcote, as with Camp Road at Upper Hayford, which runs right through the middle of their base there, the old base as it was. There were public footpaths through these bases, and you could see these buildings from there. And one of the rumors that was going around apparently in High Wycombe was that these were not residence halls or barracks at all. And when the schools were operating, they had the boys' dorm and the girls' dorm, Trinity Hall and Mansfield Hall, or Mansfield Hall and Trinity Hall. But they were actually covers for missiles. And they were the silo covers for missiles, these giant three-story buildings that were about 130 meters long, I'd like to say, each. And that when World War III came, these two buildings would slide effectively 40 feet down the hill each, and the missiles would take off. Not true. I love those urban. Sometimes there's great urban legends, and there's some that are absolutely wrong, but absolutely fun. So,
well, I mean, you know, you're very much with me here. I love these little stories and little nuggets that would otherwise be forgotten in the overall scheme of things. You know, they're not stuff that would necessarily make it into a history book.
No.
I love this sort of stuff, but you know, as you said, it does underline some aspects of the special relationship between the UK and the US that people don't know about on a much more human scale rather than on the big, you know, presidents and prime ministers scale.
Let me tell you about something that is very, and I always love this one. It involves High Wycombe again. The base itself has been redeveloped by Taylor Wimpey. So it was sold off by the MOD, 500 homes on there. The mayor of High Wycombe, on her very last day, I think it will be coming to what's now called Pine Trees. The original secret bunker was called Pine Tree, all one word. This is Pine Trees, a whole community, to celebrate the new community. As part of that, several of my former classmates and people who have been interested, who were with the Air Force and so forth, were putting a time capsule in the ground there. We've rededicated some of the roads there with names, not only of the U.S. names that were there, including some from Pearl Harbor, Eisenhower, Doolittle, names that are famous general names, too, and presidential names. But we're also rededicating a road called Kennedy Avenue. Everybody thinks that Kennedy Avenue was named after John F. Kennedy because it was dedicated in the first in the 60s. It was not. It was named after Edward Coverley Kennedy. He was a Royal Navy captain, and he went down with his ship in 1939. They had dedicated this road in 1960 originally. We're going to rededicate it in a few weeks' time. And his daughter is coming back. She's 95 years old to help us do it.
Wow.
So there's these, I don't know why the original choice was made, but the Americans felt it was important to honor this local man on the base that was in the local area there. And I think that's very important to me, too, that we're doing that. And then we're going to rename a park there after the Bobcats. I mentioned the Bobcats. I might as well mention them again. great team. One of the best teams around.
When we recorded this interview with Sean earlier in 2022, the ceremony had not yet taken place. I'm pleased to say that subsequently it has happened, and it was officiated by the then Mayor of High Wycombe, Councillor Andrea Bourne, and Deputy Mayor, Councillor Leslie Clark, OBE. Councillor Clark and her husband Martin were instrumental in working with former students of the US Military Dependent School, London Central, who attended the school there in the 1970s, in getting the roads and park reconnected with their historical past, including some of the names being named after teachers from the base school as part of the new development. Catherine Calvo-Caressi, Captain Kennedy's daughter, who was at the original ceremony in the 1960s, was the VIP guest for the second time in a ceremony attended by about 200 people, including both former US military personnel and London Central faculty and students. A time capsule put in the ground as part of the ceremony has a 50-year retrieval and opening date, if you'll mark it in your diaries, for May 2072.
But all these bases, a number of these bases, not all of them, had some schools with them, so they had, you know, they had to have families that were here. Not everybody. Younger airmen didn't have families here. But the last thing I will say on this part is there have always been special relationships between airmen and airwomen and local community men and women. And long may that continue. It still continues now. I've never quite pinned down the numbers of marriages that take place each year. But I do know that when the Gulf War was on, it was going up considerably. People were getting married, you know, suddenly deciding we had to get married before they went off down to the Gulf. That's always, I think there's a whole story on that at some point. And as we all know, going back to World War II, there are still people searching for GI fathers and in the 60s, 70s too, as far as I can tell. Fascinating, those little links to me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sean, where can people get the book from? And where can people find you on the internet?
So a couple things here. I'll say three quick things on this. One is go to that place called Bezos Land, Amazon. It's there these days, I think. It came out in 2014, so it's been a while. It's there. You'll find it there. You can actually see, I think, about 20 or 30 pages of it. Given it's 400 pages, that's nothing, believe me. But you'll get a feel for it there. In terms of where to find me on the internet, Facebook is that other name that we all bandied around a bit. And there is a website I keep for home bases called facebook.com/US home bases. So United States home bases, but US home bases. And you'll find it on there. What you'll see at the top of the page is actually a schematic of the underground bunker at High Wycombe, funnily enough. And I also have a second site. I think it's called 7 North Audley, and that's for the U.S. Navy building there, because there are a lot of people who had happy memories there, and there's some fascinating things that happened there. I would also recommend to anybody, if you're planning to come, and I do hope people come, and people are coming back, you know, fuel aviation prices aside right now in 2022 and the troubles in the world, people will still travel. I'm a big advocate of travel. And I would say, guys, if you get a chance, places like the Sculthorpe Heritage Center, the aircraft control tower at Greenham Common, there's a chance there to go see that area and understand a little more. There is a Heritage Center at Upper Hayford we both know very well. Well, it's come on since we were there. Run by a guy named Nick Porter, the Bentwaters Cold War Museum, of course. And we didn't even talk about the twin bases and, you know, and there's that whole thing with that whole side. And then at Bushy Hall, which is now called the Lincoln's Fields Children's Center in Watford, the Lincoln's Fields Children's Center, they do have there a 1940s experience, but they also have their stuff they can talk to you about the base, and you can still see some of the original buildings that were there in the 50s and 60s. So I think, you know, there's a whole thing here that there's an opportunity to do. So get out there, see these things, and you and I need to meet again at some point.
We do. We absolutely do. That will probably bring back a load of memories to some of the veterans that listen to the podcast who served in the UK, and hopefully, you know, some of them will get in contact with you and share some of their stories too.
And I hope they get in contact with you, because as you say, I mean, look, Ian, having this kind of media now and a podcast works for so many people, and I get it. For me, it was great to write a book about it and put it in hard black and white somewhere, and along with lots of pictures. And try and just capture these things before they're gone in memory, and that's my biggest call, my plea to your listeners would be: write your memories down, or put them down, record them down, video them down. Don't be scared to not do these things, because it's the only way you can transfer knowledge, transfer experience, save something if you have family or next geners, as I call them. And give them something to understand more about you.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.